kiss your lips a thousand times, and more times than I can count. I have called you mine, you have stood by me.
Live from New York City, it's the Gary Null Show. And now, your host, Gary Null.
Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Null. Today, we have so much to share. The latest on health and healing, including how your immune system kills spontaneous blood cancer cells every day. And how do you have a healthy immune system? Make sure that happens. What are the health benefits of kale? We'll get into that in some depth. And also, we're finding out that early menopause is associated with the chemicals that you're exposed to in our environment on everyday levels. So they do make a difference. And cinnamon. Cinnamon improves some enzymes that are good for you. And blue light can fight fatigue around the clock. This is from Harvard. What is blue light? We'll talk about that and a lot more. Then from our commentary segment, I'm going to do a short commentary today from Professor Henry Giroux on what's wrong with our educational system. Why aren't we having millions of students protesting on social issues? We're not. From Chris Hedges, The Menace of the Military Mind, from Truth Dig, and Marjorie Cohen, from the Huffington Post, Beyond Orwell's Worst Nightmare. What's really going on with this police state that we have? Also from our environmental segment, Fast Tracking Misery. We'll talk about Nation of Change, Ron Carver, about the Trans-Pacific Partnership. More on that. My guest in the second part of our program will be Dr. Stefan Klein. He is regarded as one of Germany's most popular authors and on science. He's the former science editor of Der Spiegel, and we're going to talk about challenging social Darwinism of the survival of the fittest versus altruism as the evolutionary key to survival. Everywhere you look today, it's always about excessive competition and those who will do anything to get ahead instead of what they should be doing. We'll examine that in depth. Then, I don't know how much we'll have time for, but I intend to have as much of the interview done in Germany, German broadcasters of Edward Snowden. This has virtually been blocked by the Department of Defense on websites all over around the United States. Even on our own website, it was taken down, and on others, and it simply was wiped clean. Fortunately, we had downloaded it, so we'll upload that where he talks about his fears of being assassinated and how people have openly condemned him and said they want to put a bullet right through his brain. And who are these people? Our top military generals. So I can understand why the Department of Defense would not want you to hear this interview. I believe that this will be the only place that you would have heard it on the radio in the United States. We'll play that interview. Let's begin. What keeps us healthy is our immune system. Now, there's actually multiple aspects of the immune system. But the immune system is constantly looking at everything in our bloodstream and in our cells. And when it identifies anything that doesn't seem to be normal, doesn't seem to be right, it immediately calls an alarm, and all forms of cells like B cells and phagocytes and other types of white blood cells undergo immediate transformation, spontaneous changes, and that leads to cancer cells being killed. And it does this 24/7. According to the journal Nature Medicine, a Dr. Alex Kallis of Walter and Elisa Hall Institute in Victoria, they report that the immune cells remove errant B cells before they become cancers. Quote, each and every one of us has spontaneous mutations in our immune B cells that occur as a result of their normal function. What's this mean in lay language? It means that if cancerous B cells go on to form tumors, they develop into B-type lymphomas, also known as non-Hodgkin's lymphomas. And the researchers found T cells of the immune system carry out regular checks to find cancerous and precancerous B cells and destroy them. How cool is that when you realize that watching over each one of the parts of the immune system is another part of the immune system that recognizes when it's not doing the right thing and then eliminates the cells that are not acting properly. So what can we do to help that? Well, it's simple. Get rid of as many of the pro-inflammatory items in your diet as possible. Coffee, alcohol in any amount, processed flours, white sugar, white rice, the cereals, artificial sweeteners, and high fructose corn syrups, carbonated beverages, all of these are pro-inflammatory. And then when you put like curcumin in the cuminoids in green tea and Manuka honey and fresh fruits like lemons and melons and watermelon in particular and vegetables, especially the cruciferous vegetables, broccoli, kale, asparagus, Brussels sprouts, you are then giving more immunity into your system. You're building up your immune system. You're strengthening your natural killer cell activity. Therefore, when a cancer cell is found, it can be more quickly destroyed. It's just that simple. I can remember when I was in Germany visiting the clinic of... I visited several clinics and also went to the University of Dusseldorf. And I wanted to find out how much science was there to back up the claims of Dr. Issels and others. And there were just hundreds of studies, not in the United States, not in our journals, but in theirs. And here was Issels. He kind of reminded me of the Lion King, a tall guy, long hair down to his shoulders, and white hair, and had this booming voice. And the first thing he did with every person who came there, almost all of them, 90-95%, were terminally ill patients who had gone through traditional therapy and it hadn't worked. So instead of going home to die, they gave one last shot going to him. And he could hold about 50 people at a time. And he would go through their body examining where they had any local infection. If it was in your gums, you had infected teeth, he'd take the teeth out. If it was, if you had infections in your blood or in your joints, he put you on a purification program. He would give you ozone therapy. He gave magnet therapy with the most powerful magnets I've ever seen. In fact, it was a giant magnetic, it looked like a tube. Just visualize a giant tube made out of magnets that you, this little portable bed that put you in it, and then the magnet rotated. And you were getting this oscillating magnetic pull, and that helped free up lymphatic drainage, getting toxins out. And then he gave you all types of therapies, and he had the best record of curing terminal people in the history of medicine. And that was independently confirmed by Dr. RDA of Leiden University. And he said to me, he said, Gary, the key is your oncologist, your general practitioner always begins with the latest medical protocol. They don't take into account the patient. The patient merely has a tumor, a cancer, a metastasis to a different organ. And based upon what that cancer is and where it's at, they'll give them a protocol. I don't do any of that. Instead, I look at getting rid of any local infection because it's the local infection that draws the immune system to it. And as a result, the immune system isn't free to fight the cancer. So I'm not fighting the cancer. I'm building up the immune system by getting rid of local infections. Now, I was there. I saw it. I interviewed dozens of patients. He had an open archive of 55,000 patient records. And people from all over the world, scientists, physicians, went there, journalists, but no one from the United States. I was the first person to do a story on Dr. Issels, did a cover story. And I went back about 6 months later, and he was just inundated because of the article, which had about 2 or 3 million readers to it. And he was getting great results. So what this means is this. It's only when you give yourself 100% commitment to clean up your immune system, strengthen your immune system, and also de-stressing strengthens the immune system, because distress, cortisol, and other hormones that are related to stress weaken the immune system. They overstimulate the immune system. Your immune system actually works against you. That's why fear, insecurity, depression, anxiety, all prematurely age you. You put yourself at greater risk of all diseases when you're distressed. But it's just the reverse. You put yourself at a greater opportunity to be around disease, not get diseased, because your immune system is strong. And that study is simply reconfirming one part of that. Kale. I know you've seen the kale chips, even if you haven't normally consumed kale. It is a part of the brassica family, along with cabbage and cauliflower and broccoli. And today, most people eat their kale as those curly little kale chips, kind of crinkly and crispy. They're dehydrated, and one of the dehydrators is about 120 degrees, so it's still a living food. And you're still getting your nutrients. Now, there's either green kale, blue kale, purple kale. So why should you concern yourself with having kale? Because it helps lower the bad cholesterol, and it reduces your risk of having heart disease. That's the reason. It's very rich in nutrients, vitamin K, vitamin A, beta-carotene, calcium, vitamin C, copper, manganese, and potassium. It gives you almost 4 grams of fiber per serving. It has antioxidants, including flavonoids, which help prevent cancer. It's low calories, and it also can reduce certain cancers because of the organosulfur compounds that it contains. So on all levels, it's good for you, lowering your risk of cancer, heart disease. In fact, one study published in the peer-reviewed Journal of Biomedical and Environmental Sciences shows that the effects of a 3-month kale juice supplementation on coronary artery disease risk factors, and it was, quote, kale juice can favorably influence serum lipid profiles and antioxidant systems and hence contribute to reduce the risk of coronary artery disease. Now, those in the health field, they regularly get kale put into their juices, their green juices. So, one more reason for you to have the good juice, put some kale into your next juice or eat kale. We live in a sea of toxins. Unless you live in nature and in a clean environment, the cities are not clean. In the air in cities are thousands of chemicals that we breathe in. The average person is exposed to more than 200 artificial chemicals per day. One of those chemicals is called PFC. That stands for polyfluoroalkyl chemicals. They're used to manufacture stain and water-repellent products. They're also known as endocrine disruptors. Studies have shown that you're much more likely to end up with hormonal problems. And now there's a new study that found that they're particularly effective at disrupting hormones in women. According to the North American Menopause Society, it can cause women to have much more exacerbated symptoms of menopause because it's disrupting the normal hormone regulation. They circulate in our blood. And so one more reason to take green juices, because green juices chelate out heavy metals. Vitamin C helps you chelate. Garlic, onions help you chelate. And acetylcysteine, chelate. Alpha-lipoic acid, chelate. So make sure you're getting the natural chelating agents. It'll help in a period of time, not all at once, but over a period of time, you can lower the risk of these chemicals in your body and therefore help to rebalance your hormones. According to the peer-reviewed journal Nutrition Research, cinnamon improves the liver enzymes and other factors in non-alcoholic fatty liver disease. Now, you've heard me mention many times that we are looking at an epidemic of non-alcoholic fatty liver disease, in no small reason because of the high consumption of the high fructose corn syrup beverages and foods, and that we live on sugar. And it also will directly impact your C-reactive protein. So cinnamon every day, put it in your smoothie, put it in something that will complement the flavor, and it'll help you. And finally, a study examines the consumption of added sugar and death for cardiovascular disease. And here's what this is found, and this was published in the Journal of the American Medical Association's Internal Medicine. And this also has been confirmed by the World Health Organization. Quote, many U.S. adults consume more added sugar, meaning added in processing or preparing for foods not naturally occurring as in fruits and fruit juices, than expert panels recommend for a healthy diet. And consumption of added sugar was associated with an increased risk of death from cardiovascular disease. And then it goes on to explain that people think they're not taking a lot of sugar, but they are. And that's causing them to add in the calories, and these are empty calories, and you end up getting heart disease and dying. So from going from where they said, oh, sugar's not bad for you, recommending it, no, it is bad for you. It's a killer. And finally, from Brigham and Women's Hospital, blue light can fight fatigue around the clock. Researchers at Brigham and Women's Hospital have found that exposure to short wavelength or blue light during the biological day directly and immediately improves alertness and performance. And this was published in the peer-reviewed journal Sleep. Quote, our previous research has shown that blue light is able to improve alertness during the night, but our new data demonstrates that these effects also extend to daytime light exposure. This was according to the doctor head of the Division of Sleep Medicine. These findings demonstrate that prolonged blue light exposure during the day has an altering effect. So in just lay language, in order to determine which wavelengths of light were most effective in warding off fatigue, the researchers teamed with a neurologist at Thomas Jefferson University who developed the specialized light equipment used in the study. And then they compared the different blue light with exposure to an equal amount of green light and on alertness, and found that it makes a big difference when you have blue light. So one of the things we can use now in helping those who are fatigued, who have chronic fatigue syndrome, Lyme's disease, Gulf War syndrome, depression, anxiety, is blue light therapy. And it's not difficult to obtain. I'm Gary Noll. We're here to talk about the issues that make a difference in our lives. I'm very concerned about the idea that we do not have any percentage at all, not even 1%, of American students standing together on issues that are essential to their own well-being as well as the rest of us. And I believe that this is going to be counterproductive to them. It's one thing to be burdened with debt that you shouldn't have. It's another thing to be overcharged in universities for mediocre education. It's something else to be in an environment where you're taught how to take tests, and you're groomed and you're tutored to take a test, but you really have no knowledge of how to think on critical issues. And as long as you get good grades, that seems to be the object, because that's what determines where you're going to go after college. But then half of all college students are going to go home, and then they're going to be living with enormous debt. More often than not, their parents have co-signed on their loans, so the parents are in debt. There's debtor's prison. You can't get out of it now. And there's compounding interest. So at every level, this is a form of indentured servitude to the corporate interest. Now, if we had a really compassionate Congress, which we do not, if we had someone in the White House who cared about people, who does not, then interest would be completely forgiven, and you would be allowed to work off this debt in a way that did not adversely affect the quality of your life. but we don't have that. Why? Because we haven't protested. And if one thing has become clear in recent months, this is the first, really the only impulse of the current government when faced with challenges to their vision of higher education. Police infiltration, surveillance, elected student leaders banned from political activities on campus, the arrest of students for simple acts of expression like chalking slogans on a sidewalk, send a clear and constant message. Today, there can be no reasoned discussion on these issues. None. There's no longer anything to talk about. Certainly, democracy has absolutely nothing to do with it. The pursuit of knowledge and understanding have been declared nothing but a constant consumer product, or else a form of technical training to increase overall economic productivity. These are the only ways these matters can be discussed. If anyone wishes together to object to this, together in places of learning, to insist that knowledge and understanding are not merely economic goods, but something precious and valuable in their own right, they can only do so by permission of those who are telling them otherwise. Otherwise, they can expect to be physically attacked. We've seen it. Surely you remember the macing of the students sitting nonviolently on the ground. Similarly, higher education has become a dead zone for killing the imagination, a place where ideas that don't have practical results go to die, and where faculty and students are punished through the threat of force or harsh disciplinary measures for speaking out, engaging in dissent and holding power accountable. Faculty in most universities have been reduced to part-time jobs and functioned as indentured servants with no benefits, shockingly low salaries and no power to shape the conditions under which they work, with over 70% of faculty now holding the status of contingent labor. They are increasingly becoming one of the largest groups of professionals that qualify for food stamps to survive. These contingent and debt-ridden faculty live in a culture in which time is a burden rather than a luxury, and have few opportunities to research, write, and engage important social issues. At the same time, they live under both a survivalist mode in a culture of fear, knowing that they can be dismissed arbitrarily at any time for the slightest infraction. Even tenured faculty are feeling the heat of a business-oriented de-democratization university. For example, the Kansas Board of Regents recently dramatically curtailed tenure and academic freedom by claiming that both tenure and non-tenured faculty who use social media in ways that were not in the interest of the university, decided exclusively by the CEO of the university, were subject to dismissal. Speech now impairs or reduces the university's efficiency, overrides the rights of faculty to exercise free speech or address issues they deem socially and politically important. For all intent and purposes, this significantly challenges tenure and all academic freedom. Moreover, as William Black points out, in both substance and dishonesty of presentation, the Regent's policy is literally Orwellian. In conclusion, increasingly students are exposed to a low-intensity war in which they are held hostage to disciplinary measures, in which they are subject to police violence and corporate and government modes of surveillance. Such practices are designed to punish them whenever they exercise the right of protesting peacefully against a range of policies that are depriving them of a decent education and turning higher education into an adjunct of the military-industrial surveillance complex. A more subtle form of a power and repression burdens them with a lifetime of debt and does everything possible to depoliticize them and remove them from being able to imagine a more just and different society. Debt bondage is the ultimate disciplinary technique of casino capitalism to rob students of the time to think, dissuade them from entering public service, reinforce the debased assumption that they should simply be efficient cogs serving a consumer economy and a punishing society. The ongoing attack on civil and civic values, critical education, and the social state has taken on the status of a low-intensity war that began with the election of Ronald Reagan in 1980, though its emergent tendencies are deeply rooted in the American past, which I will discuss on our next program. I'm Gary Knoll. Now from Chris Hedges, The Menace of the Military Mind, and then public health discussion after that. This is from Chris Hedges. I'll quote, "I had my first experience with U.S. military when I was a young reporter covering the Civil War in El Salvador. We journalists were briefed at the American Embassy each week by U.S. Army Colonel, who at the time headed the military group of U.S. advisors to the Salvadorian Army. The reality of the war, which lasted from 1979 to 1992, bore little resemblance to the description regurgitated each week for consumption by the press. But what was most evident was not the blatant misinformation this particular colonel had apparently learned to dissemble to the public during his multiple tours in Vietnam, but the hatred of the press by this man and most other senior officers in the U.S. military. When first told that he would have to meet the press once a week, the colonel reportedly protested against having to waste his time. For the next 20 years, I would go from one war zone to the next war zone as a foreign correspondent immersed in military culture. Repetitive rote learning and an insistence on blind obedience, similar to the approach used to train a dog to work on a battlefield. The military exerts nearly total control over the lives of its members. Its long-established hierarchy ensures that those who embrace the approved modes of behavior rise, and those who do not are belittled, insulted, and hazed. Many of the marks of civilian life are stripped away. Personal modes of dress, hairstyle, speech, and behavior are heavily regulated. Individuality is physically and then psychologically crushed. Aggressiveness is rewarded. Compassion is demeaned. Violence is the favorite form of communication. These qualities are an asset in war, but they are a disaster in civil society." Homer in the Iliad showed his understanding of war. His heroes are not pleasant men. They are vain, imperial, filled with rage and violent. And Homer's central character in the Odyssey, Odysseus, in his journey home from war, must learn to shed his hero's heart, to strip from himself the military attributes that served him in war but threatened to doom him off the battlefield. The qualities that serve us in war defeat us in peace. Most institutions have a propensity to promote mediocrities. Those whose primary strengths are knowing where power lies, being subservient to the centers of power, and never letting morality get in the way of one's career. The military is the worst in this respect. In the military, whether at the Paris Island boot camp or West Point, you're trained not to think, but to obey. What amazes me about the military is how stupid and bovine its senior officers are. Those with brains and the willingness to use them to be pushed out long before they can rise to the senior officer ranks. The many Army generals I met over the years not only lacked the most rudimentary creativity and independence of thought, but nearly always saw the press as well as an informed public as impinging on their love of order and regimentation and unwavering obedience to authority and single-minded use of force to solve complex problems. So when I heard that James Clapper, Jr., a retired Air Force Lieutenant General and currently the federal government's Director of National Intelligence, denounced Edward Snowden and his so-called accomplices, meaning journalists such as Glenn Greenwald and Laura Poitras, before the Senate Intelligence Committee last week, I was not surprised. Clapper charged without offering any evidence that Snowden disclosures had caused, quote, profound damage and endangered American lives, and all who have aided Snowden are, it appears, guilty of treason in Clapper's eyes. Clapper and many others who have come out of the military discern no difference between terrorists and reporters. And by reporters, I'm not referring to the boot-licking ones on television in Washington who masquerade as reporters. Carry out an interview with a member of Al-Qaeda, as I have, and you become, in the eyes of the general, like Clapper, a member of Al-Qaeda. Most generals I know recognize no need for an independent press. the munchkins who dutifully sit through their press briefings or follow them around and pre-approve press pools and publish their lies are the general's idea of journalism. When I was in Central America, the U.S. officers who were providing support to the military of El Salvador, Guatemala, along with help to the Contras forces, then fighting the Sandinista government in Nicaragua, did not distinguish between us journalists and the rebel forces or the leftist Sandinista government. They were one and the same. The reporters and photographers often, a day after or two hiking to reach small villages, would report on massacres by the Salvadoran army, the Guatemalan army, or the Contras. When the stories appeared, the U.S. officers usually would go ballistic, but their rage would be directed not at those who pulled the triggers, but at those who wrote about the mass killings or photographed the bodies. This is why, after Barack Obama signed into law Section 1021 of the National Defense Authorization Act, which permits U.S. military to seize U.S. citizens who, quote, substantially support al-Qaeda, the Taliban, or, quote, associated forces, to strip them of due process and to hold them indefinitely in military detention centers, I sued the president. I and my fellow plaintiffs won in U.S. District Court. When Obama appealed the ruling, it was overturned. We are now trying to go to the Supreme Court. Section 1021 is a chilling reminder of what people like Clapper could do to destroy constitutional rights. They see no useful role for a free press, one that questions and challenges power, and are deeply hostile to its existence. I expect Clapper, if he had a free hand, to lock us up, just as the Egyptian military has arrested a number of Al Jazeera journalists, including some Westerners, on terrorism-related charges. The military mind is amazingly uniform. The U.S. military has won the ideological war. The nation sees human and social problems as military problems. To fight terrorist, Americans have become terrorists. Peace is for the weak. War is for the strong. Hypermasculinity has triumphed over empathy. We Americans speak to the world exclusively in the language of force, and those who oversee our massive security and surveillance state seek to speak to us in the same demented language. All other viewpoints are shut out. In the absence of contrasting views, the very highest form of propaganda warfare can be fought, the propaganda for a definition of reality within which only certain limited viewpoints are possible. So said C. Wright Mills. What is being promulgated and reinforced is the military metaphysics. The cast of mind that defines international reality is basically military. In conclusion, this is why people like James Clapper and the bloated military and security surveillance apparatus must not be unchecked in its power to conduct wholesale surveillance, to carry out extraordinary renditions, and to imprison Americans indefinitely as terrorists. This is why the nation, as our political system reminds us, has been mirrored in paralysis, and this must stop. We must stop glorifying military values. In times of turmoil, the military always seems to be a good alternative. It presents the facade of order, but order in the military, as the people of Egypt are now learning again, is akin to slavery. It is the order of a prison. And that is where Clapper and his fellow generals and intelligence chiefs would like to place any citizen who dares to question their unimpeded right to turn us all into mindless recruits. They have the power to make their demented dreams a reality, and it is our task to take this power from them. End quote. Chris Hedges. I'm Gary Knoll. Back in a moment. Please stay with us.
The shark, babe, has such teeth, dear, and it shows them pearly white. Just a jackknife has old Maggie Heath, babe, and it keeps it out of sight. You know when that shark bites with his teeth, babe, scarlet billows start to spread. Fancy gloves, though, wears old Maggie Heath, babe, so there's never, never a trace of red. Now on the sidewalk, huh, Ooh, it's Sunday morning, lies a body just oozing life. Eek! And someone sneaking round the corner. Could that someone be Mac the Knife? There's a tugboat
I'd like to welcome all of you.
River,
I'm
you
Gary Knoll. In 5 minutes now, we'll go to Germany, Berlin, Germany, to speak with Dr. Stefan Klein about the challenging social Darwinism of the survival of the fittest versus altruism as the evolutionary key to survival. You will not want to miss this, as he is considered one of the brightest minds in Europe. But before we go there, just a moment for our listeners. As many of you know, Progressive Radio Network is now in its going into its 11th year. Our numbers are off the chart. I'm very pleased with how well we're doing and how many people are using our stories. For example, last week I was just told that 357,000 different blogs used just one of our articles on vaccines, with over 200,000 impressions. In one of them, The Deadly Truth About the Flu Vaccine, there was over 350,000 reads in one day. So that's just one article, and we're putting up one article per week, plus we post approximately 75 articles per day, all on progressive themes, ones you will not see on the Huffington Post or the mainstream or MSNBC media. None of the programs has ever had to take 1 second to raise a penny. We pride ourselves in that. NPR can't say that. PBS can't say that. Pacifica can't say it. So once a week, we take just a few moments, generally less than 4 minutes, to offer you something, the funds of which go to this station. And here's what we're offering today. And we haven't offered this in a long time. In fact, for the last week, I've been living off this because I've been doing my ultra-long training, and this is what I use. It's called Power Berry Blast. It's raw. It's all natural. It is phenomenally good tasting. There's over 20 exotic fruits and berries. It's loaded with antioxidants. It has over 15,000 ORAC, which is the highest of anyone out there. If the average American, even a healthy American, is probably only going to get up towards 1,000 ORAC a day, and this has got 15,000 in a single serving. It has only 52 calories. And by the way, the natural sugar in it, it's all natural sugar. For example, cherry juice, 5,177 milligrams per serving. Why? Because in this new formulation, this is a new formulation, I saw that cherries are one of nature's most perfect foods based upon what's in it, so I want it to be number one. Then we have the strawberry juice and blueberry juice and raspberry seeds. 1,235 milligrams of raspberry seeds. No one has that. Black currant juice, cranberry, bilberry, goji, aronia, acai, grapeseed extract, elderberry, blackberry, camus, pineapple, guava, black raspberry, quercetin, and it's sweetened with xanthine and stevia. It has all natural berry flavor. It's got a low glycemic index. It's non-GMO. It's got everything that it should have. So that's what you're getting. But you're also getting a bonus. And the bonus is this. You're going to get, before I left New York, and I'll be back in about 20 days, I produced a series of self-empowerment videos. I haven't done any in 2 years. And it was just time. And I did one called Empty Your Mind, Fill Your Life. As millions of Americans are at a crossroad, we're faced with doing more of the same, but wanting a different outcome. We want to be happier, healthier. We want to be more at peace with ourselves. We want joy and love. But now for the hard part, are these desires and wishes compatible with our actions and choices? And this program explores how to make positive changes so you can achieve more of what you desire, need, and deserve in life. I'm not the only one talking. Professor Bruce Lipton, Professor Amit Goswami, Ashcoast, Professor Gunga Dean, Professor Robert Thurman, Professor Ann Perez, and Professor Brenda Shoshone. So we talk about what does it mean to empty your life of all that is negative and toxic in order to be better understood for what you want. All these wonderful things are discussed. So that's my gift. That's a $40 gift. So I'm going to give you a phone number right now. Here's the number to call to get a great deal on this. All right? So write down this number, call it, and you'll get the Berry Blast, so important for you. Red Stuff and Berry Blast are actually one product, but it was too many things to put in one jar, so I had to separate them years ago into two separate ones to get maximum potency. And so I want you to get maximum potency. So you're going to call a number. So ready for that number? All right, and it is 877-627-5065. That's the right number. 877-627-5065. 877-627-5065 to get your Power Berry Blast. This you're going to love. You're going to really benefit from this. And also to get the free brand new self-empowering DVD. 877-627-5065. At a great price, too. You're saving on the jar itself a lot, and plus you're getting the $40 DVD for free. We're going to take just a moment before we go to our guest, because I was just told someone's in studio, and many of you know him. His name is Danny Jacobs. Let's say hello to Danny Jacobs. Hi, Danny.
Hi, Gary. How are you?
Now, Danny is a lawyer by profession and practiced for a long period of time, but Danny also, for several years, helped people, guided them in their journey of health and healing. And then he went to work for Alan Pressman, a well-known chiropractor, and who just closed his office and on Friday after a long career and a very distinguished career of helping a lot of people. As an educator at New York College of Chiropractic, helped revolutionize some of the courses out there, worked with me in forming the first fully accredited program of nutrition at a chiropractic college in the United States, New York College of Chiropractic. And now he's spending more time doing philanthropic work, and good for him. He deserves some rest at this point in his life, having helped over 100,000 patients. But Danny now has come back into our office. We've hired him to counsel and help people in their journey of health and healing because he's qualified in the area also. And what he did with Alan for years, he's now going to be doing, as people know, I hire people, I pay them a really good salary, so they can counsel people for free. We've counseled over 30,000 people this way, and I can't tell you how many have been benefited, a lot. And so, Danny, we welcome you to the small group, along with Larry and the others who are helping people in their journey of health and healing.
Well, thank you so much, Gary. I appreciate those kind words.
Now, Danny, what are the areas that you seem to get the best results helping people?
Oh, my. The areas that I would say would be certainly fatigue. People come in with all types of energy problems. That's a big one. It's really hard to separate these because these tend to blend together, but certainly the whole area of GI problems. Often a person comes in, they don't even realize they're having a GI problem because they're symptomless. But based upon what they report to me, symptoms, eating habits, symptoms, by the way, that could be totally unrelated as far as they know to the GI tract, I have a pretty good handle on that. People with cancer. It's really the whole gamut. Diabetes, of course, weight problems, tremendous amount of mental disturbance. I had a woman that came in today with panic attacks, and this is something for the past many, many years, for many, many reasons, we're seeing more of that. So that's just a few things that I see on a regular basis.
Are you able to help people who don't know how to shop healthily and are in limited budgets and therefore have to make wiser choices because they don't have the money otherwise?
It would be my absolute pleasure. There's so much thrown nowadays. We have the internet, which is both terrific, but it can also be misleading for a lot of reasons. And plus, a lot of people just don't have the internet. I am glad to take people because one of the things I'm so enthused about when you see the research and you see how certain foods, how certain ingredients that we've been all led to believe, we've been given such a bill of goods by the food industry, which is connected with Big Pharma, how they poison us, how they are big contributors of mental disease. I'm talking about, you know, beyond depression, anxiety, etc. I think this is a mandate, is to take people and show them what to eat and how to eat.
Good. Well, Danny, we only had a moment just to welcome you back. I know you have a lot of people in this audience who remember when you originally helped them, and those people who you helped through Alan Pressman's office. So Danny Jacobs now joins all the others, Sandy and Larry and Sherpa and all the others. That I think we have six people now that I've hired, because we have thousands of people who want help, and it's a free service. You're going to be helped. You've got to be there in person, not over the telephone, but you can call to make an appointment. Danny, the number they'll call you at is 212-874-4000, 212-874-4000, if you'd like Danny Jacobs to help you, and he's now on board full-time. All the best, Danny.
Thank you so much, Gary. I appreciate it very much. Keep up the great work.
Thank you. Now it's time to go to our guest. Let's just make sure we have our guest online, who is in Berlin, Germany, Dr. Stefan Klein. Dr. Klein, nice to have you with us today.
Hi, how are you?
And I gave you your bio earlier on in the program. You have degrees in physics and analytical philosophy from the universities of Munich and Grenoble. And also you received a doctorate in biophysics at the University of Freiburg in Germany. And your recent book is Survival of the Nicest, How Altruism Made Us Human and Why It Pays to Get Along. And the website is Stefan, S-T-E-F-A-N, Klein, K-L-I-K-L-E-I-N .I-N-F-O. A major criticism from the scientific reductionists, particularly those who abide by the view of genetic determinism, is that our emotions of compassion and empathy and altruism are irrational, and therefore they should be dismissed as being unfounded as a driving force to explain how humanity has evolved and survived. The idea that humanity has evolved due to selection of the fittest remains the dominant view. Today, most of the socioeconomic paradigm is fueled by competition. Repeatedly, we hear that competition in business will generate jobs, produce greater wealth, and will spur technological and scientific innovation. Only those corporations and businesses that are able to remain financially strong and innovative will survive. That's what we're told. However, we're now witnessing clearly the downside of this belief in the free market competitive system, which has failed to produce good-paying jobs and has only further fragmented our global society with greater inequality and class warfare. And we're not only seeing this social Darwinism dominant in the biological sciences, but it has also been adapted throughout our socioeconomic and political systems of governance as well. So I'd like you to take your time and deconstruct the weak links in the survival of the fittest belief, and then posit the scientific observational evidence that supports the view that it has been the altruist and cooperative nature of humanity that has contributed to its survival. The forum is yours.
Right. I'm not against competition, and you can't argue that competition isn't a force in evolution, both of nature and of human societies. Of course it is, but what has been overlooked is that it needs to be complemented by another side, and that is by another a driving force, and that is cooperation. That's what distinguishes us from most animals. Humans would have never come so far if they had to rely only on competition. And that's what the current social economical dogma wants us to believe that competition is the only driving force, well, it is not. And you can very well see this from the workings or the non-workings of capitalism itself. And the perfect example of this was the financial crisis we had witnessed in the years 2008 and following. Now, what happened? Essentially, it was a crisis of trust. So when after the crash of Lehman Brothers, the banks started to mistrust each other and not to lend money out anymore, the world economy was virtually at an abyss. Now, according to the teachings of neoclassical economics, this shouldn't happen. Because a category like trust would not matter, right? In the standard teaching, how they make us believe how economy works, the only driving force is the interest of everybody for himself or herself. So you wouldn't need something like trust or cooperation. But even that system doesn't work, and if it should rely only on trust, if there was no trust present, and you would have no trade, no exchanges, no cooperation whatsoever. So what I argue in my book, The Survival of the Nicest, is that the current teaching must be complemented. And there are very strong arguments and very strong findings to show this. And interestingly, it is Darwinism itself that shows that cooperation among humans must always have been a strong force to complement competition. Now, how can that be? Now, Darwin himself, very different from what is being told about him, he was a very compassionate man, and he saw very clearly that even in very what he called primitive societies, today we would say small scale societies, there must be something like trust, like empathy and trust. And he couldn't explain how that happened, because he argued that nature was red in blood and thought. Now, today we know how this could come about, and the reason is essentially that in order to be able to develop large brains, in order to become intelligent, humans first had to develop something like empathy and cooperation. And why this is so, you can figure out very easily if you remember how much it took you to raise your child and your children. Now, to get a child stand on his or her own feet, it takes 15 years, 20 years, doesn't it? And that has always been so. Now, in a harsh environment in which our ancestors live, constantly threatened by starvation, by illnesses, by predators, nobody would have been able to gather so much food that you could feed your children for 15 or 20 years. You would just have starved. So our ancestors could only procreate if they work together by pooling their forces, by pooling their risks. And this is what a new theory, what a new reading of Darwinism shows very convincingly, that groups which cooperated fared well over time, whereas groups where everyone was for himself just would die out over time. And in the long run, this made a selection towards the survival of the nicest. Those are forces which we still see today. So we are kind of hardwired, we are naturally hardwired for cooperation, for feeling with each other, for acting upon others, right? You would see this very natural tendencies. You would see this very early on. There have been fascinating experiments being conducted in the last years, both here in Germany but also in the U.S., which showed that children, no matter how they were raised, would start to help each other with the aid of 18 months, right, very early. And it doesn't matter if they are boys or girls, it doesn't matter in what cultures they were this occurs completely spontaneously. And a little later on, with 3 years or so, they develop something like a rudimentary sense of fairness. And they start to share. So this is really not something that education needs to bring about. This is innate. This is a part of our human nature. We have a little neglected over the last decades, and now science is rediscovering these forces very forcefully. It has also been shown that it depends very much upon the environment you live in, how much these natural tendencies to cooperate and share, how much a role they would play in a society. So if you live in an environment where you don't need much trade because everybody can produce, every family can produce what this family needs for itself, then those people wouldn't have very strong norms of fairness. They would have norms of fairness because they are innate, but they don't develop them very much.
Well, we understand your comment. Dr. Klein, we're out of time, and I appreciate you taking your time over in Berlin and Germany and coming on with us. My greatest concern is over genetic determinism, which wants to assign physical and mental disorders solely to genetic causes or disruption in gene regulation. And so much of modern psychiatry today, which is fundamentally drug-based, wishes to associate mental disorders strictly to genes. And once we accept that belief, then we dismiss environmental and social and familial settings that you're talking about to shape behavior. So I know that we must challenge genetic determinism. It's invalid. And it's dangerous. And also there's a whole movement now to try to create the ideal genes. And I think we all can see where that would go. You would have people who have the money. You have about at least 20 million people would have the money to have the perfect genes, the perfect children. What exactly would that do for everyone else that doesn't have these perfect genes and perfect disposition and perfect control of temperament and perfect, you know, structure? It would mean we would be obsolescent in a moment. I thank you for your good work, and we look forward to another conversation on this topic. The book is Survival of the Nicest, How Being Nice Made Us Human, and Why It Pays to Get Along. Website is Stefan, Stefan Klein, klein.info. I'm Gary Knoll. Thank you all for listening. Let's say hello to Utrice Lead now. Hi, Utrice.
Hello, Gary. Today is the first of two programs about health and healthcare disparities in the United States that have long shown up, major inadequacies in the Civil Rights Act of 1964. What is needed, our guest says, is a Human Rights Act for the 21st century that truly outlaws all forms of discrimination.
Okay. Right now, Utrice Lead, please stay with us.